From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. In 2 hours, numerologist Glynis McCants joins us. Looking forward to her look into the future. President-elect Barack Obama has secured access to the second half of the $700 billion financial rescue package after the Senate voted 52-42 to kill a measure that would have blocked the fund's release. So we'll see what he does with that when he takes control. And Bank America and the Treasury Department are near an agreement that will provide $15 to $20 billion in new government support to the banking giant. The injection of fresh capital will come from the government's $700 billion rescue fund and will be similar to assistance provided last November to Citigroup. Bernie Madoff's investment fund may never have executed even one single trade, according to industry officials, suggesting detailed statements mailed to investors each month may have been an elaborate mirage in a $50 billion fraud scheme. An industry-run regulator for brokerage firms says there was no record of Madoff's investment fund placing trades through his brokerage operation. Now, this means that Madoff either placed trades through other brokerage firms, a move that industry officials consider highly unlikely, or that he was not executing trades at all. A New York couple is haunted by calls from credit agencies wanting to collect debt that their dead son owed. Rocco and Lori Cremini's 27-year-old son Vincent collapsed and died nearly a year ago of a sudden heart attack while he was playing softball. Since then, bill collectors have been calling and writing to his parents constantly, trying to get them to pay his credit card debts. The family's lawyer sent at least one letter to each company explaining the circumstances, but got no results. And then when reporters got involved, at least one creditor, Macy's, agreed to close the account and leave the grief-stricken family alone. Do you believe in miracles? Well, I do, and there was one today. A U.S. Airways jet crashed in the Hudson River between Manhattan and New Jersey after a flock of birds apparently struck its engines. But all 155 people on board are thought to have survived okay. The pilot is being hailed as a hero. There were just minor injuries. Passengers were sent fleeing into the icy 35-degree waters when the Airbus 320 went down near 48th Street in Manhattan shortly after taking off from LaGuardia Airport. The pilot is being hailed as just somebody incredible. He is a former Air Force fighter jet pilot from the 70s. In Hayward, Wisconsin, a man who froze to death in Wisconsin while sleepwalking outdoors in bare feet sometimes took a sleeping pill, and authorities suspect that he had also been drinking before he died. Investigators found a bottle of Ambien in his bedroom, but they've not yet determined whether he took the medication on the night of his death. The 51-year-old was found outside his home hours after the temperature plunged to minus 16 degrees. In Poland, a crook tried to dodge a police search by disguising himself as a carpet. The thief rolled himself up in a giant rug and propped himself up against a balcony wall while cops searched his aunt's flat in Warsaw, Poland, after being held up of a cosmetic shop. He was only found after a two-hour search when a fed-up detective went out onto the balcony for a smoke, and he noticed that the carpet was trembling. The 32-year-old man is now facing 12 years in jail for armed robbery. A Chinese couple desperately seeking a cure for their daughter, who has been laughing nonstop now for 12 years. The mother says it started when her second child had a fever when she was just 8 months old. Ever since, she's been laughing uncontrollably. I can't get her to stop. Scientists are moving closer to creating a real cloak of invisibility. Researchers at Duke University, who developed a material that can cloak an item from detection by microwaves, report now that they have expanded the number of microwave links they can block, Last August, the team reported that they had developed a so-called set of metamaterials that could deflect microwaves around a three-dimensional object, essentially making it invisible to the waves. The system works like a mirage, where heat causes the bending of light rays and cloaks the road behind an image of the sky, for example. Scientists at NASA have found new evidence of methane gas and water vapor in the atmosphere of Mars, which they say might have been produced by living organisms. But they stress that the discovery is not definite evidence of life on Mars. NASA is due to send a second robotic rover laboratory to Mars in 2012 to examine the gas more closely. Now, they believe the gas could have been produced by microbes, very small living organisms, or even volcanic activity, but they don't see real evidence of volcanoes. As we mentioned a few days ago, noted astronomer and Coast to Coast guest Thomas Van Flandern has died. He died of colon cancer on January 9th. Just an incredible guest here on Coast to Coast and an amazing person. In his book, Dark Matter, Missing Planets and New Comets, he presented various controversial cases, including one that Mars is a former moon of an exploded planet formerly located in the asteroid belt. And some also believe that there are also structures, artificial structures, on Mars. In a moment, we'll be talking with several people who knew Thomas Van Flandern very well. This very brief tribute to a very special man in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. As I just mentioned, we have lost a dear friend and special guest here at Coast to Coast AM, Dr. Thomas Van Flandern. He succumbed to colon cancer several days ago, and we have several guests who'll be coming on this portion of the program to talk about the life of Tom Van Flandern. First of all, Michael, Tom's son. Michael, how are you? And our condolences to your family, my friend.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roy, and thank you very much for doing this.
Well, I cannot tell you and express, and I'm sure some others will far better than I when they come on in a second, Michael, tell you how important your father was to this show, this audience, and also this entire community that is trying to investigate and unravel these great mysteries. I had a chance to meet your father face-to-face several months ago in a conference that both of us were on the panel, and just what a delightful guy, Michael, just a wonderful person, and you should be proud of this person.
Well, I am. I'm very proud. My father, I feel very, very fortunate having grown up with him, and a lot of things I think I took for granted, I very, very painfully feel now that he's gone. But my father was my personal hero. He was a very good man, and he was a very bright man. And he was a scientist through and through. I think the best thing I can say about him is he had enormous integrity. He took unpopular positions and knew full well the consequences that he would suffer for taking the unpopular positions, but he felt compelled to go where the science took him.
You know, when I was with him several months ago, he showed no signs of being in any pain at all, and I've got to tell you, Michael, honestly, I did not know that he had colon cancer.
He hit it pretty well. There was a crisis in cosmology conference he had organized in the Olympic Peninsula area, where some scientists from around the world had gotten together in September, and he had thrown himself into that project fully. He wasn't feeling very well since August, but he had dismissed or ignored, worked through some of the discomfort that he was feeling. But by October, it was starting to get very, very uncomfortable for him, and in early November he went into a hospital, and it was at that point, I mean, up to that point he thought he had a flu or a bug, and he went into the hospital and found that he had a metastasized colon cancer that was completely inoperable and was given no long-term chance of survival.
Michael, tomorrow night we're going to devote the last 30 minutes of the program to your father and play my most recent interview with him, and just give you an opportunity, if you're up at that wee hour, if you want to listen to that, we'll be playing it tomorrow night.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'm going to put you on hold, Michael, so you can hear the comments of the other guests here. Or if you've got your radio on in your home, you can just simply go and retire to your living room and listen to the rest of these comments. Mitch Batros, of course, Earth Changes expert, sent me an email yesterday, a couple days ago, notified me of the passing of Thomas Van Flander, and I had not heard of it until Mitch got a hold of us. Mitch, I wanted to thank you for that, by the way. It was very kind of you to do that.
Well, you're quite welcome, George. And if I can get through this interview without breaking down, I'll be in bed in good shape. That's the effect that Tom had on people who knew him. As his son, Michael, has just outlined, that's much of how the professional community views him on a scientific level. But as you know, George, having met him, the depth of this man and the humility that he has is overwhelming. And what he brought to us is still unfolding as we speak today. It just so happens, just by coincidence, or is it,
yeah.
As I know your stance on that, George, two articles have just come out, and it's almost like Tom helped this happen. One happens to be about Comet Temple 1. Now, that goes right to the heart. That's the Deep Impact mission. That goes right to the heart of what Tom Van Flandern was all about, and that is this. He has always believed that a comet is really nothing more than an asteroid. And he goes beyond that and says that with his exploded planet hypothesis, that is the source of much of the asteroids that are being tracked today. He goes further and challenges today's scientists, what I call the new scientists, scientists that are in their 30s and 40s. And I'm talking the highest of the highest in NASA, NOAA, the European Space Agency, and so forth. And he has challenged them directly. One time on my show, Dr. Kerry Leaf, NASA scientist, he is one of the senior scientists of the Deep Impact mission. He's also the guy who points the Hubble telescope at different celestial orbs. Well, I had him, Dr. Leaf, and Dr. Van Flandern on the show in a debate talking about the Deep Impact.
Yeah.
And the respect that Dr. Leaf had for Tom was immense. You could feel it over the air. Now, they disagree, but you could hear as Casey was laying out his thoughts, he knew the background of Tom. Now, remember, Tom has been around really since the 50s, but known back in the 60s. He is a senior member in the international astronomy community. And because of that depth, although people may disagree with Tom's hypothesis, they respect him in every way.
He stuck his neck out, Mitch, so many times with his incredible alternative ideas of space and astronomy, did he not?
Oh, yes, he did. Again, that goes back to the integrity of this man. He was filled with passion and commitment, and he knew what was happening. Matter of fact, even on the show, I very gently would bring it up about peer reviews and, let's face it, blackballing. He knew what he was up against, and he really put his reputation on the line. However, let's talk about his pedigree. This is a man, for your audience who may just be meeting Dr. Tom Van Flandern, was with the U.S. Naval Observatory for 21 years. And then later in other astronomical settings. And then, of course, he branched off to meta-research of his own science community. So he has a depth of knowledge, and he's been one of the good old boys, if you will, and he is well familiar with how it works. So he brought that with him, and very gently, again, going back to the humility of this man, he would very gently, because he knew what he was up against, bring this new thought into the community, such as Dr. Casey Lease and many others. Another well-known one is Dr. John Bradley, which is in the newspaper again just today, and that's the Stardust Project. Dr. John Bradley, again, one of the senior members of this project, which is revisiting Deep Impact. And the what's coming out of this is that what Tom had always said is that they aren't dirty snowballs, these comets, that it appears to have come from somewhere and not just the Oort cloud, that he believes that that planets, known as the chaos theory, that planets had been in collisions, Mars being one of them, which I think your further guest will bring up, and be able to deliver this wisdom in both our community, your and I community, George,
yeah,
and the well-established mainstream community.
He made, Mitch, a lot of mainstream scientists wake up. And like you said, they didn't always agree with him, but they always listened. Mitch, again, thank you for bringing this very sad story to our attention a few days ago. And I appreciate you being on the program here with your comments. Dr. Roger Lear, of course, knew Tom Van Flandern. And there is not a conference around, by the way, where Dr. Roger Lear is not invited. And he's everywhere. Roger?
Hi, George.
Hi.
It's a very, very sad night for me, being on the show, addressing Tom's passing. I considered him not only an exquisite scientist, but a wonderful human being. And he stood on many thresholds and was not afraid to take the next step. He was out there, and as we just heard from Mitch, it was it's just indescribable, all the tentacles that he had that surrounded various aspects of not only astronomy but other sciences. Now, ANS Research was formed some years ago. And I usually don't talk about any of the science members of the science board, but I'll say at this time, in deference to Tom, Tom was one of our first members.
Well, I've got to tell you, Roger, you know, we've lost so many great people in this community. John Mack, of course, Eugene Malov, Alternative Energy, and now here, Tom Van Flandern, with his incredible theories on things that could have happened in the solar system and the universe, and he will sorely be missed. And I thank you for your comments, Roger.
Yeah, Tom reached out, and he adored science, and he was out there in ufology, too. Just a quick side note. I introduced him to a friend of mine who was one of the world-leading geneticists in Australia, who had taken up the subject of crop circles in a mathematical way. And I put him together with Tom, and although Tom couldn't see in the beginning what this gentleman was talking about, later he came to give his opinions in relative to this crop circle subject, and that's the way he was. He would reach out with a warm arm and embrace things that he was really interested in. And I'll be indebted to him forever.
The person, of course, who brought Tom Van Flandern to you, this huge Coast to Coast family, this huge audience, of course, none other than the head of the EnterpriseMission.com and our science advisor, Richard C. Hoagland. And this one, Richard, has hit you like a brick.
You know, when you sent me the email a couple nights ago, I looked at it and I couldn't believe it. I thought, come on, this has got to be George's wacky, weird sense of humor.
I'm weird, but not that weird, Richard.
And then you sent me the second email, which was, of course, the obit on the Meta Research site. And I have not been able to stop thinking for 2 days about the tragedy and the timing of losing not only a dear friend, but someone who was an extraordinary scientist, a colleague, someone who really, you know, we live in a culture where there's a lot of lip service paid to a lot of things, and political spin is everywhere. People wear public faces. You see them on television. You hear them on radio. You hear them on this show. And you know they're not the same off the air as they are on the air. Tom was not that kind of guy. He was exactly the same person of deep integrity, deep sincerity, incredible deep curiosity. He was the quintessential scientist. And I've been thinking, you know, knowing we were going to try to do something tonight, how long I've known him and when we first met. And it's so long ago that I had to really stop and think. You know, it's like you know, part of your limb is missing.
Yeah.
When you know, like today, we're going to talk in a little while about some major developments on the NASA front.
And what I want you to do, Richard, too, when we come right back, because we're going to talk about Mars, is tell me your greatest Tom Van Flandern Mars story, because that'll get us into this incredible story about Mars with you when we come back. At midnight Pacific time, Glynis McCants, the numbers lady, joins us for a couple hours as we talk about some incredible things going on with numerology. And also when we come back, Richard C. Hoagland comments again on the life of Tom Van Flandern. We're going to get Richard's reaction to NASA possibly finding life on Mars, or at least clues for that. And then next hour, Robert Zubrin, Mars Society, joins Richard as we talk about this incredible possible discovery. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you and Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, I remember many moons ago you sent me an email and said, hey, how would you like to do a story on Mars being a former moon of an exploded planet? And I went, yeah. And that's when you brought us Tom Van Flandern, and what a great story this is.
Well, it's a great story. It's a real story from a real scientist. And I was thinking, as I said before the break, how long I've known Tom. And it turns out that I knew Tom for over 30 years. We first met in Pittsburgh, on an afternoon in Pittsburgh, at the University of Pittsburgh, at what's called an annual DPS meeting, the Division of Planetary Sciences, which is a subsection of the American Astronomical Society, which is kind of like a union for astronomers,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, scientists all belong to the, you know, various disciplines. Well, the astronomers have this loose union, the American Astronomical Society, and the folks that work on planets, that are looking at the solar system and working on various NASA missions and, you know, looking through telescopes and gathering planetary data, they have an annual subsection meeting called the DPS meeting, Division for Planetary Sciences. And the reason that I met Tom there is that I had traveled there from Berkeley, California, where I lived at the time. This was during the years of Ronald Reagan as president. And Ronald Reagan had a budget director, whose name I think was Stockman, who was hell-bent for leather to essentially kill NASA, to kill all the cool stuff in NASA. And one of the things that Stockman had set his sights on was killing the Voyager missions after they left Jupiter en route to other parts of the solar system.
Whoa, no,
Voyager was, in essence, a poor man's grand tour, which NASA had originally envisioned as a spacecraft that would be sent, actually two spacecraft, that would go from Earth to Jupiter, Jupiter to Saturn, Saturn to Uranus, Uranus to Neptune, and then out of the solar system. And you can only do this about once every 175 years because of the way the planets orbit the sun and the configuration they have to be in to do a slingshot, you know, one to the other, to the other, to the other,
mm-hmm.
and save a huge amount of fuel. Basically, you get four for the price of one. And the last time that it was possible to do this, Thomas Jefferson had been president. So this whippersnapper budget director of President Reagan comes in.
Davis Stockton was his name.
Exactly. And he's going to cut the funding for Voyager to try to trim NASA, to trim the fat from NASA, the waste, the abuse, you know, all the usual cliches. So a bunch of us, both inside the NASA community and outside, and I was kind of like an outside. I mean, I had been an advisor to NASA, but I was no longer an advisor. I was actually writing for Star and Sky magazine at that time. And I went to Pittsburgh to the DPS meeting to basically raise hell. Carl Sagan was a friend of mine, and he was going to be there, and he was going to raise a little hell. And, of course, his voice was, you know, a lot more powerful than a lot of the rest of ours.
Yeah.
And I remember after some of the meetings, and, you know, scientists organizing politically is about as bizarre as having fleas organized to turn the dog.
They don't do it.
They don't do it. They don't want to be political. They would, if they were political, they wouldn't be scientists. They'd be something else. So it was really interesting. That was my first taste of, you know, confronting the system, the political system, to get something important that we all realized was historic and would never happen in our lifetime again, changed over a stupid, you know, bean counter kind of mentality. So in the break between one of the sessions, we went to the student union to get a bite to eat. And it was crowded, and there was obviously a lot of students around. Gosh, those guys. And there was this one table with, like, one chair, and I took my sandwich or whatever, and I sat down, and there was this distinguished scientist-looking guy wearing a gray suit, tie, impeccable, coiffed hair, munching something. And I asked, you know, can I sit down? And he said, yes, of course. And we started talking, and he told me his name, Tom Van Flandern, Dr. Thomas Van Flandern. And then somehow the conversation quickly moved into the Twilight Zone, because Tom was not really that focused on Voyager, although he was interested in what Voyager might detect in the way of imagery when it got to Saturn, because he was very interested in this moon that I, frankly, was not very familiar with at that time, called Iapetus. And, you know, we started talking about why. And Iapetus is a moon which has one very bright side and one very incredibly dark side that's been known for 300 years since it was discovered by a French astronomer back in France in the 1700s. And he started to lay out this idea for why Iapetus could be a test of his theory, his model. So, of course, I fell into the trap and I said, well, Dr. Van Flandern, what is the model? And that was the first time that Tom laid out, in the middle of this crowded student union with kids running around and Coke and, you know, the usual, you know, backpacks and the hustle and bustle, and there's these two guys sitting in the middle of this, you know, din, and he lays this idea out that the solar system was the product of some amazing, gargantuan, ancient, mega-year-old explosions where an entire planet had blown itself to kingdom come, where the asteroid belt now lives, and the debris shockwave and, you know, incredibly burned cinders and all the detritus from that explosion had went coursing through the solar system as this set of shockwaves, and had plastered one side of Iapetus, which has an 80-day orbital period around Saturn, which would be kind of like a time capsule. So he was interested in preserving Voyager so it could get to Saturn to take the pictures of Iapetus to try to prove his totally, totally far-out theory. Now, you obviously, are all you sitting in the audience listening, are thinking, wait a minute. Hoagland is calling somebody else far out?
Yeah, really.
Because in those days, I was Mr. Straight-Laced Mainstream.
You were mainstream.
I was squeaky clean mainstream. I was, with trepidation, going up against the White House and the president and the budget director to try to save a NASA mission and not exactly knowing how we were going to pull off this impossible idea. But I certainly wasn't viewing, you know, NASA as hiding things or... And here was this guy sitting across this little round table in the middle of, you know what student unions are like.
Oh, sure.
And he's laying this incredible vista of a solar system that had never, ever dawned on me, where amazing things had happened that had repercussions and implications and was testable. And he started telling me about his political problems of, you know, getting the guys, his colleagues, to take him seriously. Well, that was the beginning in October of 1979. So 30 years ago, give or take, that's how long I've known this incredibly honest, courageous, real scientist amid all the other folks I've ever met.
He opened your eyes, didn't he?
Well, you know, if I really want to blame somebody for what I'm doing tonight...
Tom did it.
I think it's Tom. I think he's it.
Well, I've got to tell you, when you brought him to the program with us, it must have been, what, a year and a half ago, something like that?
Yeah.
And I'm listening to his views, and I'm listening to yours, and I'm saying, now, on one hand, I've got this science researcher, investigator, writer, you, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got this doctor of astronomy, and they're saying the same thing. What's wrong with this picture? And you know what? There wasn't anything wrong with the picture.
Well,
it was a remarkable story.
When you follow your curiosity, which is what science is supposed to be, it's not supposed to be a club or a union or a pressure group that doesn't want to get too far out of the box because of what the other guys will think about you. You know, this concept of peer review, which Tom and I had long discussions about over the years, is the thing which is killing science. It's not the peer review so much as the invisible, anonymous peer review, where basically before a paper can get published, and in the next hour or so we can get into a very interesting specific right in front of us example right now, you know, you have to go through so many hurdles, and there are so many chances for guys who have it in for you who don't like you or who don't like the idea that you're trying to propose in a scientific publication can basically, you know, stick you in the back with a shiv and you never know. You know, the one of the tenets of the U.S. Constitution, which is coming back in vogue, by the way, have you heard that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is that you have the right to confront your accuser. In the peer review system, which has now been set up for science, not only in the U.S., but worldwide, the scientist who is basically on trial for an idea, because that's what it is, by any other name, it's really a trial, is attacked by invisible accusers called referees who get a chance to shaft the idea, kill the idea, nix the paper, tell the editor of whatever journal, oh, this guy's a total wacko, don't go, you know, mm-hmm. 5 light years near him, and you never have the opportunity to confront your accuser and demand that he be specific as to what he or she has found wrong with your idea.
That happened to Tom a lot, didn't it?
It happened to Tom a lot. It happens to all the cutting-edge guys. And Tom set up Meta Research to basically try to create the vestige of an alternative scientific system that would bypass this terribly pernicious idea of anonymous peer review and allow review of ideas, but review where everybody is on the same level and you know who the guy who doesn't like your idea is and you can confront him, which, of course, is a fundamental tenet of the United States Constitution.
You know, he would write these peer-reviewed papers and the speed of gravity and issues like that, but those detractors, who we never knew who they were, would pop up and talk about his claims of artificiality on Mars and everything else to try to dismiss him.
Well, see, that's kind of...
And he
like,
never backed down, Richard.
No, he never backed down, but thereby hangs a tale. Because after my initial contact with Tom and his amazingly bizarre, totally off the wall, it cannot possibly be real idea of the exploding planet hypothesis, mm-hmm. that we live in a solar system, one of billions and billions, where planets, for some reason, pop off. The planets are not immortal, that something will make, eventually, a planet explode. Now, that, of course, politically, is a very unsettling idea. Can you imagine NASA coming out and basically saying, hey, guys, we all live on this planet called Earth? Well, we got this example, you know, yeah. Two planets over that You know, it lasted for a few billion years, and then one day it just went bang. I mean...
And it could happen here.
Exactly. And what do you think that would do to the stock market?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So there was a major geopolitical reason, I think, and still believe, for the non-acceptance of Tom's idea that he received during his entire professional career when he got into following that trail. But, you know, there is such a thing as karma. And Tom's karma came around to bite him when decades later, this is now, what, 1983, 84, somewhere in that time frame, we came back in contact, and I introduced him to the problem of Cydonia, the face on Mars,
uh-huh.
artifacts. And you know what Tom's reaction was?
What?
You're nuts.
Like you thought originally when
Absolutely.
You met him.
Absolutely. And it took him about, I would say, a year to two to three, maybe, to do his own digging. See, this is what separates the real scientists from the idiots and from the pretenders and the ones that are just going through the motions
yep.
for the money.
They do their own research.
Tom did his own research, and he got in touch with several of the original players, like DiPietro and Molinar, and he made measurements of the best photography that was available back at that time. It was Viking. That's all we had. And he came to the conclusion, based on the Viking data, that in fact, we were right. That the Mars face had too much symmetry and violated too many Nuri-type coincidences for it to be a random object pummeled by the winds of Mars and sandblasted by the dust storms and the product, i.e., of natural causes. So in 1998, this is now 11 years ago, within a month or two, when the Mars Surveyor mission in April of 98 finally went to Mars after a 20-year hiatus where we had sent nothing to Mars, Tom was ready. Tom was prepared. Tom and I, and a couple other people, Mark Carlotto, of course, and you know, but it was a tiny, tiny field at that time, were prepared to look at the new NASA data coming from Mars Surveyor and to comment scientifically on what those pictures showed. And he was very courageous. He was resolute.
Unflappable
and persistent. Ever since that moment until literally the day last Friday that he died, that in fact there had been this incredible ancient civilization with extraordinary powers and capabilities on Mars that probably extended elsewhere in the solar system. And some of our conversations, I remember once when I was getting ready to do an interview for Omni Magazine, which did a profile on me and the Cydonia work sometime several years after Tom and I got into the whole Cydonia thing. Tom and I had a discussion about, you know, the EPH, the exploded planet hypothesis, in light of the artifacts on Mars and the testimony to an extraordinarily advanced ancient civilization. And he volunteered. I didn't have to really push him, but he volunteered, which I thought was extraordinarily courageous, for, again, a real bona fide credential scientist who spent 20-plus years as head of celestial mechanics at the U.S. Naval Observatory and, you know, with a degree from Yale. You can't get more mainstream than that, guys. Tom volunteered that it might have been possible that the explosion of Planet 4, or Planet 5, rather, the one that, you know, lives now where the asteroid belt is, mm-hmm. which Mars had orbited, may not have been due to natural causes. That, in fact, it may have been a humongous, horrendous, catastrophic, and totally insane interplanetary war with technologies that would boggle the mind, that make H-bombs look like candles, that had been used to basically blow that planet to kingdom come. Now, we flash forward the film to a guy who was listening to us tonight, Joseph Farrell, Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Yes.
And, Joseph, you damn well better stay healthy, because I'm losing too many good friends. Joseph has picked up the cudgels of that idea. And in his series of books, starting with, I think, the Giza Death Star, and moving through his look at the Nazi recreations of ancient technologies, etc., he has now put real meat on the bones of the hypothesis that Tom's EPH, his exploding planet hypothesis, may in fact have two causes. One is that, yes, naturally over time, planets may in fact at times explode due to internal forces. And the other possibility is that there was this incredible cosmic war of which we are one of the results, that resulted in what Tom spent his entire life trying to figure out.